Well, thanks for coming to Class 8. It's been a long time since Class 7. We were just discussing what happened last time. If you remember, we were supposed to discuss Chapter 7, but I had actually prepared Chapter 8. So what I'd like to do, what we did actually because of that, was to look briefly at Chapter 7 and Chapter 8, both. So what I'd like to do today, since it's been so long, is maybe review briefly each chapter from 1 through 6 so that we remind ourselves of what we've actually covered and where we've come from and where we're going. I'm sure all of you have it completely mastered. So that part of the class will probably be very short. And then I'd like to spend a little bit more time on Chapter 7 and Chapter 8 both, because we just went through them quickly last time. So let's start our review. And if I open up the book to the first chapter, it simply says Copernicus and the Jews. And I'm wondering if anyone remembers anything important from that first chapter. What set the stage for our investigation?
Presumption.
Presumption to think that people remember? Or
about the planets.
Long established order setting the stage for his thought.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how was that described in this chapter? I think that's a nice way of summarizing it, actually.
An analogy was presented that just as people all over the world used to believe that the sun and the moon and the stars all revolved around the earth, somebody came along and came up with a different concept that the earth revolved around the sun instead of the other way around. Mm-hmm. And when Copernicus put forth that idea, how radical it was to everyone at his time. But, you know, ultimately he was closer to the truth than they were by far.
Right. And what was it that Copernicus used to show the falsehood of the geocentric theory? What was it that he pointed to show that there was a problem with the prevailing view, the way that people in general thought?
The planets.
Right.
Because they didn't orbit around the Earth the way the sun and the moon thought was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Their orbits were erratic.
Erratic, exactly. So the analogy that's drawn out in this chapter is that the Jews are also rather erratic as a people and seem to show that the prevailing systems of the world throughout history are not the right ones. And I think Jews have done that in various ways, but specifically here talking about the general system of Christianity or Christian politics and theology that grew up, and how the continued existence of the Jews and their place in the scriptures seemed to show that something was wrong with the prevailing ideology. So the analogy is drawn to the Jews in trying to come up with a different way of looking at the scriptures to better understand who God is. So it's not really saying that we have to put the Jews at the center. It's saying that the Jews are the planetoid, the wanderers, that prove the system wrong, that just don't fit. And that's actually one way that Jews have been described by many people, as a nation that just doesn't fit in with everyone else. They're different for some reason. And God himself said that they would not be reckoned with the other peoples of the earth, that he made them different. So that is exactly the analogy that's set forward. And of course, the claim is made that even as the Copernican revolution transformed the world, so too can this change in understanding the scriptures. And I think what Ellen said at the beginning was very relevant as well in the book, the whole idea of authorities and how authorities are treated and whether one is simply to accept what has been said and passed down from generation to generation to generation because it has that trademark, whether it's Aristotle or the Catholic Church or the rabbis or what have you, whether one simply accepts what's said by that authority, which is what those authorities claim should be done in many cases, or whether there's a different way of getting at the truth. And of course, what Copernicus was doing was in opposition to that way of simply accepting authority. Now, I've also heard that reading this chapter can be somewhat disorienting for some people who may misunderstand it in various ways. I don't know, Herta, do you want to relate a little bit?
Well, it was chapter one, but mainly also chapter two was
okay.
The one that really got people that had been given the book by us and I've heard from other people that have simply handed this book to the relatives. And just like we had questioned, it's kind of ironic that the chapter that deals with the Jewish Greek and the bad translations and the misunderstandings and also deliberately construed ideas is the one that has been giving people a lot of trouble, because they didn't have the understanding that the entire book is really to help to get you to the right track, to be able to translate or be able to understand the Bible the way it was meant to be understood, and to go back to God's Word and identify the things that were translated incorrectly. The confusion was that people really looked at it as, this book is just an anti-Bible book, and so we're not going to continue reading it. Because until you get up to the other chapters, and then you have to tell the reader, well, no, it's really, you need to go further into it. It's not anti-Bible. It is simply helping you identify the problems that happen in translations, intentional or unintentional, and get you back to what the Bible really says.
But that's pretty much what the whole theme of the book is, because that's exactly what was happening with Copernicus. That
right.
The established authority of the Bible, as we see it in the New Covenant Scriptures, in the English translation that we have, people believe that is the true authoritative Word of God, and it's not necessarily true, just like it wasn't true that the planets revolved around the Earth.
Right. But those of us that came to this class and came into it knew that this is what we were going to be studying and why we were trying to study it. If you simply give this book to someone without all of that explanation, then they get very confused the first two chapters as to what are you trying to achieve. You're just trying to badmouth the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Does anyone else have any comments on that or any thoughts? Have you had any experience like that at all? No.
I could reinforce that it can plunge one in to a depth that is beyond oneself. Yeah.
Okay. that's an interesting way to put it, I think. I just want to reinforce what was being said, that the purpose of the book, of course, is the opposite. It's to try to take away things that are anti-biblical. It's to try to get at the truth. So if there is, something in this book that seems like it's anti-Bible in some way, it's either a mistake in the way it's presented or an error in the person reading it understanding either one, it doesn't really matter that much. But it's something that if it arises in our class, we should be able to clear up in some way. Yeah. So I think it's important to emphasize that.
It's helpful when you read most books to just, bear out, with the person, be patient and hear them out like you do in normal conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Just hear a person out while you're reading a book and not to draw conclusions like this is... get suspicious right off the bat.
Right. I think, like Ellen said, it does sort of plunge people into a depth they might not want to go into, and it can be very startling for some people, in my experience. Yeah.
I think that this also, that every single word, written word, people give their own interpretation to the written words,
Mm-hmm.
And you just need to go deep and like keep reading to have the right meaning. That's what I think.
Right.
Is it possible to add a graph? I don't know if there's any modification, in the back burner or something like that, if anything like that's being considered, but would having something that lays things out into a logical pattern instead of the chunky, pithy paragraph following another might make it easier if there were an accompanying graph.
Okay.
Possibly.
It's an interesting idea because some people are more visual in how they learn things. I'm not sure exactly what the graph would look like, but maybe we can talk about that afterwards, for instance. Mm-hmm. But that is an interesting idea.
And also I think it's a big difference if you're looking at, if you're reading this book from brought up in a Christian setting, or if you're reading this book brought up in a Jewish setting.
Right.
It brings it at you from a totally different perspective.
I think so, yes. Yeah. And a lot of the things that someone coming from a Jewish background would think or feel upon reading this book would be completely different from the things someone from a Christian background would think or feel when they read this book. Yeah. Okay, well, let's move a little bit to chapter 2 at least, which was on Jewish Greek. Mm-hmm. And this sort of set the stage for a lot of discussions on mistranslation or misleading translations in English and in other languages, of course, but we're dealing mostly with English here. What would you say was the main thesis of chapter 2 on Jewish Greek?
Identifying huge.
The transliteration, huge, was that where we were? Is that where words that were just a sound borrowing from the prior language of Greek, or that words in Greek that had no particular religious connotation were used specifically so that a new meaning that was Hebraically based could be overlaid onto that and derive more meaning.
Okay.
But that also these words of Greek came to be established with a higher significance than they than they deserved is really the right thing to say.
Than they would have in non-biblical text. Yeah. Okay, that's definitely part of it. Let's try to flesh that out a little bit. Can anyone add anything to that?
Maybe some of the reasons that brought the mistranslation of some scriptures is one of the things that we have said, like, if the text was written in Jewish Greek, so when the people were translating, like, they needed to have understanding of, first of all, the language, and second, the context in which the language is expressed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The historical context. Right. So what do people usually think about the so-called New Testament? You know, what kind of a text is it? What language is it written in? Who is it written by? And so forth.
It's commonly thought that it's a form of Greek, the koinonia, something like that.
Koine Greek, yes.
Koine Greek.
Meaning common Greek. One of the ways in which it was expressed here in the book when they talked about the systematic errors is that a common conception would be that the New Testament is a Christian document written in Christian Greek or Koine Greek. And the thesis of chapter 2 is that, no, to the contrary, the New Testament, in quotes, is a Jewish document written in Jewish Greek. And that changes the way that you would translate it. It changes the way you would understand it, just as Ileana was saying. You have to understand the text in its historical context, and you have to understand the language of the text in its historical context. So there's no question, for example, that there was something that we could identify as Christian Greek some centuries later, and all of the church fathers, well, not all of them, but many of the church fathers wrote in this Christian Greek, and Christianity was carried on in the Byzantine Empire and in other parts of the world in Greek for centuries. Actually, at the Council of Nicaea, which many people would take as the establishment of official Christianity, Constantine spoke in Greek to address the majority in what was their native language, or what was the common language, because most of them were from the Greek-speaking part of the Roman Empire. So certainly at some point in history there was this Christian Greek, but that's not the point in history when Yeshua lived, or when his Talmidim, his students or his disciples lived, or the Jews who wrote these texts. And they didn't think in Christian concepts, which hadn't been really invented in the same way yet. They thought in Jewish concepts, because they were Jews. And so that's the basic thesis. And the way that we can sort of demonstrate this, and the way one sort of historical artifact that helps us understand it, of course, is the Septuagint, looking at the Greek, the Jewish Greek translation of Tanakh, of the Hebrew scriptures, which was produced so that people could read the Torah and the prophets and the writings in the Greek language. So how was the Septuagint produced 200 or 300 years before Yeshua?
A large group of people.
Okay. Well, how did they go about translating? They have to take Hebrew concepts and put them into the Greek language. They have to take something from a biblical world and put it into the language of a world that is dominated by polytheism, paganism, and so forth. How do they do this?
Well, they had basically two choices. One was to transliterate a Hebrew word so that it would sound about the same in Greek language, and then people would have to be educated as to what it meant. The other way was if there was to try to find a Greek word or group of words that would express more or less the same concept as the Hebrew word. So it would be using an existing Greek word, but it would be using it in a way that was a little different from the way the Greeks were used to using it.
Okay, yeah. So without going into all the details again, basically they're going to take Greek words that exist and try to match them up with Hebrew concepts. So that's why we have all these pairs that we talked about. One of the pairs being, of course, Mashiach and Christos, in which Christos, a Greek word, is imbued with a much deeper and broader significance than it had in the Greek world because of its association with this Hebrew word. And there are many other pairs of words that are produced, and there are some quotes from scholars in the book that describe this process. But the basic idea is that, yes, they would try to express Hebrew concepts through using some form of Greek words. In some cases, they couldn't come up with any Greek equivalent, so they would simply transliterate. In other words, bring the letters across instead of trying to reproduce the meaning and so forth. But the point of all this is that in the Septuagint, you have the creation of a Jewish Greek language. In other words, it's written in Greek letters. It's using what seem to be Greek words. But it's not the same kind of text as is being produced in Greek in the rest of the Greek-speaking world. It's radically different. And the concepts that are being expressed are not the same as the general Greek concepts. They're Jewish concepts, Hebrew concepts, being expressed through these Greek words in the Greek language. And as part of the context for understanding this, we mentioned that there are many Judeo-hybrid languages. That in almost every place the Jews have gone, they've created some sort of hybrid language to express Hebraic concepts combined with the native language and maybe the native culture in some instances. What's one example?
Ladino,
Yiddish are the most famous examples. So the thesis of this chapter then is that the Septuagint is kind of a bridge from Tanakh to the scriptures that are written in Greek, and we have to understand how the Septuagint was created in order to understand the language of the Messianic writings. And if we don't understand that, then we'll be misinterpreting and mistranslating those texts. And of course, usually that has not been done in translation. It's only a few people who have tried to do it in translation, and there isn't really an English translation that actually takes that approach. Okay, any final questions or comments on that one? Because it is really a central point of the book. I mean, a lot of the remaining chapters rest on understanding this idea of how the Septuagint is this bridge. Yeah.
This phrase, I can't remember. Who is it that wrote
Well, we don't have any one person that we can say wrote the Septuagint. According to tradition, it was 70 or 72 elders or rabbis or, you know, scholars from the Jewish community.
200 B.C.
Yeah, approximately.
For the library in Alexandria, I guess, or it's debated whether it's for Jews or for Gentiles, but
right.
Whatever.
Exactly, yeah. There are usually two different explanations. Most people say it was produced for Jews, Hellenized Jews who no longer spoke Hebrew, so that Jews could read the scriptures in the language that they knew, which was Greek now, many of them, those who lived in what became the Eastern Roman Empire. Alexandria had an exceptionally large Jewish community, and that's where it was produced. If you watch the Abba Ibn film, that's the explanation that he gives in the film, that it was produced for Jews who no longer spoke Hebrew. The other explanation is that a monarch of Alexandria actually requested it to be made, so that he could read it, and so it may have been produced actually for Gentiles, for non-Jews. But we may never know that, but in any case, it was produced. And the translation process is very interesting. Okay, well, let's look at chapter 3 then. And we can maybe go a little bit faster. I would like to definitely remind you of all of these things, because I do think the chapters build on each other. But we can probably go a little bit faster. The third chapter was on Dr. Frankenstein's Neighborhood Bible Club. And the subtitle expressed the thesis that the Bible does not contain a New Testament or an Old Testament, which is an interesting proposition. Now, also, I'll just mention that also in the Abba Ibn film, there was an explanation of why it's called the Bible, which is that when it was translated into Greek, the Septuagint, it was given the name Biblos, which means book, the book, you know, the book that the Jews are obsessed about, the book that the Jews are always reading. And that's what Bible is. It's just a transliteration of that Greek word. So, meaning book. So, if this book, this Bible, does not contain a New Testament or an Old Testament, why is that the case? What evidence is there to believe this? And what is even meant by that statement? Because if you open up most English Bibles today, it will say very clearly Old Testament, and then you get 1,000 or so pages, and then it will say New Testament, and you get a few hundred pages.
This was the naughtiest of chapters for me. I had to look things up in the dictionary, and even the American dictionaries didn't properly explain the old meaning.
Is that naughtiest, K-N-O,
yes,
or,
thank
okay,
you.
All right.
What has to do with the fact that they weren't testaments, they were covenants? So they were translated right off the bat, the books were translated improperly. And it also goes on to say that the testament, at least in the NIV and such, that you had to have one party die in order to have it be valid. And we didn't have, that doesn't come into play in a covenant with what God was talking about.
Okay, yeah. So what were covenants, first of all?
Promises.
They were made with blood. They were sort of like agreements between two living parties.
Okay, agreement. What else might you translate a covenant as?
Pacts.
Pact, a contract. So the Hebrew notion of brit, B-R-I-T, which is usually translated as a covenant, means a certain kind of contract between two parties. Mm-hmm. Could be more than two, I suppose, but it's usually two. Mm-hmm. So this idea of a contract has to be understood if it's going to be expressed in later documents. So, how did we get from that to saying that there are two sections of the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament? What's the connection between this idea of a covenant and the Testaments? Or anyone, but you were talking about it, so. And it's good preparation for seminary.
Well, unfortunately, the covenants were made to the people of Israel, and not necessarily to anybody else, but that all nations would be blessed through the people of Israel. But the there was silence for 400 years between Malachi and the coming of the Messiah, and people believe that that what we often get is that the New Testament is the covenant that God made with the Christians and made in the Christian world to give us Christians.
Okay, yeah. I mean, there are many different aspects that all come into play here, so we can't deal with all of them maybe, but...
It basically supersedes the old covenant, the
right,
old scriptures.
Right. The first part of the problem is this idea of supersessionism, by which God's grace is his new plan, and it supersedes his old plan, which was the law, not understanding that certainly all throughout Tanakh you have discussions of God's grace, his chesed, his mercy, chen v'chesed, and so forth. According to the same system, the Christians are the new people of God, and they replace the Jews, who are the old people of God. And then also with the books, this new set of books supersedes the old set of books. And certain scriptures were used, usually out of context, to support this. You know, things about, behold, I have made all things new, things like that. What is old is passing away. We won't get into all of that, but that was the basic approach of Christendom to its faith for centuries, for millennia, in fact. And it's only now, only really in the 20th century, in the 21st century, that it's kind of dying away a little bit, this idea of supersessionism. Well, that was the major influence, probably, in helping to create this idea of... two completely separate categories for these sets of texts. One set of texts before Yeshua and one set of texts from Yeshua on. So they were called the Old Testament and the New Testament. You have that described in the chapter. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but these names were given to them, and they were inappropriate names for two reasons. First of all, Testament was a mistranslation of covenant. And secondly, neither of these sets of books was a covenant in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. A covenant is a specific agreement between two or more parties. And so there may be covenants or contracts included in some of these books, but that collection of books, whether you're talking about 39 books or 27, but whichever collection you're talking about, thank you. That collection of books is not in itself a covenant. I mean, a large part of Tanakh is poetry. A large part of Tanakh is history, right? So that whole collection of the Torah, the prophets, and the writings, that cannot be called a covenant. That's not the meaning of the word covenant. So that was one mistake. And similarly, of course, with Matthew to Revelation. I mean, we can't say that those books are a covenant. They include history, they include teaching, they include all kinds of things. And they do mention some covenants, usually when they quote from Tanakh. So the actual covenants that they mention are actually in Tanakh, not included in their own body of work. So the one mistake is calling these different groups of books covenants, which doesn't really make sense. And then the second mistake was mistranslating as testament instead of covenant in places where that word appeared, and then adopting this as the title of the book. So again, I'm not going to go into the details. You can look at it in the chapter. But the idea of a testament is very different from the idea of a covenant. The idea of a testament is that someone is dying and bestowing property or making arrangement for what's going to happen after his or her death. That's not what's going on in a covenant. So the instance that Bobby was mentioning in Hebrews, which we looked at in some detail, was a very important one, because translators struggled to sort of twist it into something that would make sense in English by saying that in making testaments, someone had to die, when actually what one of the parties had to die. Well, there's only one party in a testament anyways. But what the text was actually talking about were covenants in which the parties remained alive so that the covenant could go into a force. And so this misunderstanding of these two words was very problematic in creating a translation that was accurate, or even a translation that made logical sense. Something else I wanted to note from that chapter, though, is that we spent a little bit of time showing that all of this information is explained in the same way in commonly available Christian reference works. So this is not new. This is not like just a Jewish perspective or Jewish-centric perspective. It's commonly understood. It's just not practiced. It hasn't been put into practice. And I wanted to give you another example of that, which I came across just this last week as well, looking at Bobby's new interlinear Greek-English New Testament. And in the preface to this interlinear edition, the compiler says, "Due to the principle of translating each Greek word literally, a number of translations have emerged that are quite different from other versions." So in his translation, in the way he translates the Greek words, he's different from others. So here's his first example. "The Greek word designating the mother of Jesus has always been translated Mary. But most often the Greek word is actually Mariam, properly meaning Miriam or Mariam rather than Mary. So we have given it," and so forth. So there, and he goes on to give other examples as well. So again, it's not that the specific examples and arguments here are unique and no one has ever heard of them before. In fact, people who work on the subject should know all of these things. It's just when you put it all together into a composite image and you see the whole structure that it is so startling that most people don't want to accept it. If, again, if they've come from that type of a Christian background. In any event, we can move on to something that's probably even a little more controversial, although just as obvious in the reference works, which is the topic of chapter 4, a good church is hard to find. Why is that? It's because there's no church at all, good or bad, in the Bible for us to find, at least not church as it's understood today. In fact, what does exist in the biblical text? Well, God talks about his community. He uses common words for people gathering together, assemblies in both Hebrew and Greek. The Greek words are ekklesia and synagoge. Ekklesia means an assembly. It might be a city council, for example. There were ekklesiae of different Greek cities and city-states that were called that. So it's not a specific word that's only used here for the church or anything like that. We mentioned that it was used in Acts for the riotous mob that wanted to kill Shaul and other Jews when they found out that they were Jews. They knew they were Jews. That's why they wanted to kill them, because they were preaching about one God. So that mob was a gathering, so it's called an ecclesia. So ecclesia does not mean just Christian church, as it's commonly taken to mean.
I thought the big points with this chapter were that not only did the Septuagint translate things as assembly and congregation, but then when they got to the English New Covenant, it became church as opposed to assembly or congregation. And then you had more transliteration. So you had transliteration from the Hebrew to the Greek, and then transliteration from the Greek to the English to mean certain things like the apostles and all that kind of stuff, where you have things that just never existed in the original text that all of a sudden have developed through the translations.
Yeah, that's the next chapter too, though, the office directory.
Okay.
You're right. I mean,
but also who translated it too, and what was the purpose in the translation? Because we know that in this chapter it tells us that Tyndale translated it as a literal translation, and for his hard work he was put to death for it because it didn't reflect what they wanted.
Right, and the King James translators said that they did not want to be so accurate, basically, to paraphrase. They didn't want to be so accurate. They wanted to keep the ecclesiastic meanings. They didn't want to be scrupulous. They wanted to be ecclesiastic. They wanted to be theologically correct rather than biblically, rather than textually correct.
We got a movie about Tyndale called God's Outlaw that we just got a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to watch that soon.
Yeah. It could be one of the weeks.
Yeah.
But the result was not trivial, because what was done is that although ekklesia and synagoge were both common words meaning an assembly or a gathering of some kind, in translations they were systematically rendered in ways that would be anti-Semitic, so that whenever ekklesia appeared in a positive setting, it was given as church. When it appeared as in a negative setting, it was given as assembly or gathering or something like that, so that people reading in that language wouldn't even know that it was the same word. Whenever synagoge appeared in a positive setting, it was given as assembly or gathering or something like that. Whenever it appeared in a negative setting or a specifically Jewish setting, it was given as synagogue, and people in that language wouldn't know that it was the same word. And so one of the most infamous examples, of course, was in Revelation, where the scripture talks about a synagogue of Satan, a gathering of Satan. Right. So that was specifically associated not only with some Jews, but with all Jews. Right. That's what Jews were considered to be, the synagogue of Satan. So this was a complete distortion, and it appeared to be intentional as well, because it's clearly, you know, motivated by certain desires. And Ileana brought in a book on the popes and the Jews for that class also that showed some of the damaging effects in history of that particular translation. Well, chapter 5, which Bobby was getting to, was the office directory. And here we dealt with another translation problem, again arising from the failure or refusal to translate from Jewish Greek, in other words, to look at the text in its historical context, but rather to view it as some sort of Christian document written in Christianese, Christian Greek. And the basic issue here was that transliterating instead of translating certain words created a problem. There were certain words that described functions that you could fulfill, such as being a servant or a manager of some kind. But these words in scriptural translations, and a lot of this goes through Latin, of course, to our languages. In those translations, they were transliterated. And when you transliterate something, it tells people that it's something different. It's something that doesn't exist in their language. And so this is what happened. In the words of the subtitle here, transliteration creates the illusion of Christian religious offices. It makes it seem like there's this whole new set of authority, this whole new hierarchy, consisting of presbyters and apostles and deacons and bishops and things like that. And again, if you look at reference works, even Christian reference works, they'll tell you that that's not a good way of rendering them, because that's not what they meant. They just had simple functional meanings. Diakonoi were people who fulfilled a kind of service. Exactly, they served. So a better translation would actually be servant, which sounds rather different than deacon, by the way. Especially in a lot of churches, sounds quite different. You know, for some people, it's a big thing when they become a deacon, you know, and they have parties, and it's like getting a medal or something. Becoming a servant probably wouldn't produce quite the same reaction among most people. But that's what the word meant. And so this illusion is created of this new hierarchy. That's a problem for a lot of reasons. And recently I came across another example to sort of drive home the point. We had the Torah portion maybe 2 weeks ago, Beishalach. Was it 2 weeks ago?
Something like
it starts, I think, in Exodus 13, and it says Beishalach Paro Etam or something like that, when Pharaoh sent out the people. And this is the same word, the same root as Shaliach, which is someone who's sent out, which gives rise to apostle, apostello. So, because an apostle is someone who is sent out. So if we were to follow the same system that these translators followed, we would have to say that the people of Israel, when they left Egypt, were apostles of Pharaoh. It's the same thing. He sent them out, Beishalach, in the sending out of Pharaoh. So that, I think, is such an extreme contrast that you can see how different this world is that's created by the transliteration. Apostle instead of someone who's sent out, deacon instead of someone who serves and so forth.
Well, modern Hebrew, like all the other all the rest of the world, like a shaliach is an emissary.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or an envoy or something. Mm-hmm. Right. In a more official context, yeah. And that's appropriate for ancient times, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be understood in that context rather than becoming an artificial sort of position and title that seems different and new and strange, maybe. And we talked about how there are other functional words that were actually translated, talking, for example, teachers or elders. And so those were better because they seemed to relate to things that people already knew, that just were the common function of people in their communities. Okay. Any questions or comments at this point? I hope this review is useful.
It's been very helpful. It's been very enjoyable, too.
Well, chapter 6 was on the topic of the people coming to Yeshua. And like most of the chapters, it sets up a predominant or prevailing view, usually a Christian view, but often these Christian views are spread throughout the general population, and then proposes an alternative, just as in the Copernican Revolution to a certain extent. So the common Christian perspective is that the Jews rejected Christ, or the Jews rejected Jesus. Mm-hmm. Some people today might revise that slightly, but it's still the common Christian conception. In contrast, chapter 6 states the Jews responded positively to Yeshua. It's a quite different perspective. And then we went through a large number of verses all throughout the Gospels talking about the reaction of Jewish people to Yeshua. And there were what we found is that in almost every instance, there were crowds and multitudes following him. The people hung on his every word. They couldn't get enough of him. In fact, he had to flee away at times so that he could get away from the people, the Jewish people, who were following him all over the place.
The multitudes.
The multitudes, right.
Yeah.
And do you want to repeat your comment about growing up and what you thought?
The multitudes weren't Jewish.
That was how you understood it in Catholic
school. Right, because it was when it was mentioned, the multitudes did this, and then some Jews did this. And then the multitudes did this, and then some Jews did this.
Right.
So nowhere was it ever mentioned that the multitudes were Jews.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's largely related to the topic for today. Fred has written on the board in Greek, Iudaioi, the translation which gave rise to saying, you know, the Jews for certain groups of Jews.
Right.
And not giving the context in any way that these people are also Jews, by the way, the majority of the people that are being described, who react differently. So from these verses, it quickly became untenable to say that the Jews rejected Jesus. In fact, we see masses of them following him, and an important verse, which we mentioned in several different classes, actually, was in Luke 24, on the road to Emmaus, was there's a very clear statement of how the followers of Yeshua viewed the situation. And I think it's in this chapter as well. At the end, probably. Maybe it's not here in this chapter, but it is described in different chapters, and it's certainly relevant for this chapter. There's a brief mention of it on page 99 in the next chapter. If you remember the story, there are two disciples who are going to Emmaus, and Yeshua appeared to them, and they didn't recognize him.
Right.
And they said to him, "Are you the only one?" He started asking them questions, and they were shocked at his ignorance. And they said, "Are you the only one who doesn't know what's been going on in Jerusalem?" And he said, "Well, what's been going on?" And they said, they told them about this guy, Yeshua, and they hoped he was going to be the one who would save Israel. But the chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. Whereas all the people held him, we all believed him to be a prophet. So that is the, as it says here, that is the simple biblical view. In other words, all throughout the Gospels and beyond, it's presented as the large masses of Jews receiving Yeshua very positively, and many of them believing that he was a great prophet, as the Sanhedrin itself admitted, That's why they didn't want to arrest him during Passover, because they feared a riot of the people, the Jewish people, if they arrested him, because they said all the people hold him to be a prophet. Others believed he might be the Messiah, and so forth. So the Jews actually overwhelmingly accepted Yeshua. Mm-hmm. But the chief priests and the rulers, the authorities appointed by the Roman Empire and responsible to the Roman Empire, had him handed over to death. So that's a very different perspective as well. And in fact, when one puts that in context, you can see that actually the reason that Yeshua was killed is because so many Jews followed him. It wasn't because the Jews rejected him that Yeshua was killed. It was because the Jews accepted him. And this was a threat to the authorities in place in the Roman Empire, in Roman Judea. And if you remember from the Abba Ibn film, that's how he presents it there as well. Mm-hmm. That Rome was very nervous about all these insurrections and uprisings and any possible messianic figure or rebel leader. And so they crucified thousands of Jews, and among them was Yeshua. He died among his people in the same way, because he was a threat to that authority system. So he was actually killed because he was popular among Jewish people, believe it or not. Well, that brings us, I think, to chapter 7, which dealt with the theopolitical rulers who actually wanted him killed. And this was the chief exception to positive Jewish response. We discussed this a little bit, of course, and there was a lot of evidence in here about the corruption of the rulers and what their interests might be, basically money and power, which seemed to be rather popular interests throughout the history of the world, in the history of people who are in charge,
of course,
in particular, and how they viewed Yeshua as a threat, and how they managed to get him killed for what actually could be conceived as a crime in the Roman Empire, claiming to be a king or being a king without the permission of Caesar.
Were there other Jewish rulers as well, ones that were more truly God-centered, the rabbis and whatnot, or were these people the authority, the established authority, and who would anyone else be?
Well, the Sanhedrin was the established authority over the land of Judea when it was controlled by the Romans. So there could be other people like Yeshua who would arise and teach and gain a following.
Prophets.
But right, exactly. But they were not part of the official authority structure. Now, it also doesn't mean that anyone who was part of the authority structure was necessarily corrupt and evil to the same extent as the people described here. But in general, that's the picture we get of them. I mean, I think in every government, there's a certain amount of corruption and evil.
Barney Frank and Kennedy.
In the United States government today and in every era, there's been a certain amount of corruption and evil. But there have also been people who don't conform to that corruption and evil in every, I don't know about every government, but in most, you know, governments, most instances that has existed.
Nicodemus, Gamaliel. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so Nicodemus is an example I was going to mention. He was apparently one of the top Pharisees, and he went to Yeshua secretly at night. And it says that other Pharisees also believed in Yeshua, by the way. So it wasn't all of them, but it was certainly the contingent that could gain control. Now, Judea was not the only part of Israel, of course. And the situation I'm not entirely clear on all of the different regions of what was Israel at the different times, but in various times the situation could be a little bit different. So you remember, for example, that Herod had dominion over a certain part of the land, and in fact, Pilate even didn't want to interfere with Herod's jurisdiction. So in different regions of the land, there could be perhaps different power structures that did exist under Roman authority. But that's the basic idea is that in Judea, the Sanhedrin was the supreme authority. And in fact, any authority that did exist in Roman Israel would have to be sanctioned by the Romans.
What was the difference again between the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin?
Well,
Pharisees were part of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin had two parties in it, if you may, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And Paul, split them up when he said, "I believe in the resurrection." They started arguing about it, and he just practically walked out.
It's like the Congress, for example.
Yeah.
It's like Congress where you have Republicans and Democrats. And let's say exactly.
Like
right, you just go in and say
the tax cuts.
Right.
The Democrats did really well last night too.
Right.
But it was also, I think, important to remember that they were not all necessarily religious leaders. Some of them were just political leaders who happened to be very powerful people who were put in charge to keep the Jews in check under the Roman rule. And so they weren't expecting a Messiah, and they didn't understand a Messiah. And others did understand who Messiah was and who had come or who had thought they had come.